From the backstretch at Saratoga, this is Loose on the Lead with Steve Bick and Seth Merrill. Loose on the Lead is sponsored by...
Good morning. Welcome to Loose on the Lead. It's another Sunday morning at Saratoga. That means Seth Merrill and Steve Bick. Lenny Shulman also joining us on this Sunday morning. So, Steve, good morning again.
Good morning, Seth. It's been 8 minutes, the question that was posed yesterday by me to you and Anthony: would there be a wardrobe change? With me, it was 2-5.
I had to live up.
How about that?
I thought I looked really sharp in the seersucker this morning too, but I still had to live up to you.
Well, and I refrained from saying how cockeyed the tie was, and how the knot was like over here, you know, like little Bo Peep with the. But I will say I'm very impressed, and you went 2-for-2 on Sacco tie ties.
And I'm now over on the front side every day. I'm getting a tie comment virtually every day from about half a dozen people. So yeah, thanks for that too.
Well, I want to test your powers of observation, because I obviously changed up as well. But how complete was the change?
Shoes too, maybe.
Wearing pants?
Different glasses.
We switched up the glasses. Oh, look, well done. The crack team. Unbelievable. What a job. Unbelievable.
See, I look
execution.
What are you talking about? The knot's right in the right spot.
The right spot? The thing is halfway up your collar. What are you talking about? Look at you. Who's the guy that used to do this with the Rodney, right? Unbelievable.
So yeah, the Loose on the Lead Las Vegas residency. We promise 8 costume changes a night.
Yeah, it's the Concord.
Us and Cher. Come down to Treasure Island, and
speaking of, you mentioned Concord. Did you see the special, the Concord special?
No,
it's heartbreaking. I mean, it is absolute Cutchers. It was actually the Cutchers. It's a documentary that was made as it was closing, and you'll not a dry eye in the house. I mean, it's rough.
At least to go to the basketball game at Cutchers when I was.
They talk about it.
Yeah.
They talk about it.
Yeah, every year that great NBA players up there.
Yeah, well, he was very. They were very friendly.
With Wilt, going back to Wilt Chamberlain.
Wilt Chamberlain, yes.
I remember Dave Cowens was just coming out of college. It was the summer before he joined the Celtics, and he was up there playing, and they got everybody.
Yeah,
everybody.
It was a big deal. Fundraising, and you should see it. You'll enjoy it. And, of course, everybody should buy the latest. I brought the Lenny Shulman collection.
This is unbelievable. I could have brought my diet. I could have brought my Oneida Daily Dispatch clippings.
I should have brought my Oneida. My daily. We both worked for the Oneida Daily Dispatch while I was at Colgate and Lenny was at Syracuse.
So, yeah, but thank you. That's a lovely display there. I hope I don't kick it down.
They've stood up nicely, and of course the first was the Dan Henry, right? Dan Henry, the
Ride of Their Lives. Yep. Yeah, and then points. We're missing the Ride of Their Lives, the jockey book, but that's okay. We can still buy that on Amazon.
I don't think I have that.
It was a profile of like 12 jockeys, Chris McCarron, Gary Stevens, Lafitte, Pat Day, Mark Guidry,
really?
Georgia Chavez. Came out about 2003. Chris Antley was...
Oh, so it was before I started on the radio.
Yeah, so, and it's being updated because a new publisher has bought the Eclipse Press titles, the library, And they want me to write a couple more chapters to update it. So they're going to bring it down.
He's busier in retirement than he was when he was working.
Who worked when you were working? You know, you screwed off all day. Now I actually work. It's
unbelievable.
Amazing.
How was the book signing the other day?
The book signing was great. We sold out at the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we didn't have 8,000 of them, but we sold out every copy that we had, which was great. Had some friends, had some new friends come by, and of course the big one is coming up this Friday.
Oh, this is going to be great.
August 6th
at Northshire.
At Northshire Books on Broadway, 424 Broadway in Saratoga. I ran into Tom Durkin at the Hall of Fame. He assures me he will be there with me signing books.
Wow.
So come down to Northshire, 6 to 7 p.m. Friday, this Friday, and meet Tom Durkin. Who is included in the book as one of the legends. Yes, head-to-head, there it is.
Yeah, talk about the book. Fill people in on what they can expect head-to-head.
So it's a collection of interviews from my years at the Blood Horse. It's in pure question-and-answer form, so it's the actual interviews and not the articles. And, so it kicks off with Penny Chenery. I have a whole legend section, people like Penny Chenery. Ted Bassett, who's turning 100 this October.
Amazing.
Bobby Frankel is in that section. Tom Durkin, Tony Leonard, the great photographer. Cott Campbell, who has changed the world of horse racing as we know it.
Yeah.
And Bob Baffert. So that's the legend part. Charlotte Weber came into the Hall of Fame while I was signing. So I said, come on over here, Charlotte. You're in the women's chapter. So she came over and was gracious enough to buy a book and was highly complimentary of it. But there's a whole section on women, such as Barbara Banky and Charlotte and Josephine Abercrombie and Helen Alexander and just so many, Mary Lou Whitney, Maggie Moss, so many prominent women in the sport. I don't think the sport gets enough credit having
Agreed.
Women on
and
equal riders. Footing.
What about the riders?
So, yeah. Oh, well, the riders, veterinarians, exercise.
Yeah.
So that's a chapter. We have a chapter on Kentucky Derby winning owners, Bob and Beverly Lewis, who I did a wonderful interview with, and Mike Pegram and Jerry Moss and Paul Redham. So we have like five or six different sections. We have a celebrity section. I can't leave that out. Sam Shepard, who loved breeding thoroughbreds.
Oh, that's interesting.
And was one of the most intimidating interviews I ever did, just because it's Sam Shepard, as
he's
a writer.
He's so low-key, though, right? He
was low-key, but you knew he was Sam Shepard. you knew he was somebody, David Milch, same thing. To be able to interview a writer like David Milch is just unbelievable. So, and Bo Derek's in there, and Rick Pitino and Joe Torre and Mike Imperioli and Jenny Craig. So, yeah, it's some glitz. There's some glitz to it.
So what was Sam Shepard like being a breed? I mean, was he one of those guys who, hey, I'm over here, I'm a celebrity, but I'm kind of really into this. So when we're talking about this, they light up sometimes.
As a teenager, Sam Shepard worked on Rex Ellsworth's ranch in California, hanging out with cowboys and wanting to be a cowboy. So, no, Sam was totally into horses, into the Western culture. I mean, this was not a guy who was doing it as a sideline.
Yeah, yeah.
He was serious about it. He told a great story about getting kicked off a Woody Allen movie that he was supposed to be in, but they had to give him his per diem money. It was about $2,000. He went right to Hollywood Park and bought a horse at the sale at Hollywood Park, and that's how he started in the horse business and ended up breeding a few stakes winners. Filly named Two Trail Sue and her family.
Oh, yeah.
And, He bred probably five or six graded winners, Sam. So, no, he loved it. He had a farm in Midway, Kentucky. Sam was great. And David Milch, of course, is one of the great characters of all time and talked very frankly about his gambling and about owning thoroughbreds and about, addiction and betting thoroughbreds. And he, too, he owned a ton of great fillies that nobody remembers. I mean, he won the Breeders' Cup races with Val Royale and Gilded Time, but he also had you know, cafe latte and a half dozen, you know, grade one winning fillies that he ended up, you know, selling at a... He made a bunch of money as an owner, but he gave back five times as much at the windows, unfortunately. But great character. So the book is just full of their stories and their words. So I get to stay out of the way and not ruin them. And there's just a ton of great info in there and a bunch of great stories.
Yeah, nice. And remind people again that the signing this week.
Signing is August 6th, this Friday, at North Shire Books. It's right on Broadway in Saratoga Springs, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. So leave the track a little bit early, get over there, and meet Tom Durk and myself. It should be a fun time.
Yeah, for folks who aren't familiar with Saratoga, it's right in the middle of Broadway, right in the middle of everything. You won't be able to miss it.
Now, we've talked about the book. We talked about it well in advance of it coming out, and then as you were sort of editing and compiling and making, you had plenty of other options in terms of adding to it. There's people in here, and what's poignant actually, Lenny, when you think about it, there's a few people in here who obviously we can't hear from. And then when you think about, you know, Governor Jones's health has deteriorated quite a bit. In fact, this is probably as good a time as any to do this since Governor Jones's name came up. I had Brett Jones on the show on Friday, and I asked Brian, Mike Riccio, South Point Sales, who is well known. Brett spoke on behalf of the fundraising that's going on as he fights for his life and his wife and infant, post-infant, but very young twin children. And there's already been $250,000 raised in 3 days, which gives you an idea. And I did want to put this up. Let's, if you could, Brian, are you ready for that? If you have it?
Oh, you said you didn't get it.
I sent it to that address that he said. All right. Let me at least read the address for people.
I think there was a big fundraiser in Lexington this weekend, I want to say.
Yeah, they want to put together a trust, essentially, for the children. Riccio Family Support Trust, care of Ryan Key, 866 Malibu Drive, Lexington, Kentucky, 40502. The Riccio, R-E-C-I-O, Family Support Trust, care of Ryan Key, 866 Malibu Drive, Lexington, 40502. And Mike's got a consignment for both the select sale and for the New York bread sale, which they're going to go ahead with, obviously. They have to. And it's really hard. It's been a heartbreaking week. I know that there's countless people listening who have done business with Mike or, you know him, affectionately known as Soup or Soupy. And the industry is unbelievable. And you can speak to this, Lenny, as part of the sequence of conversations. The industry responds to this kind of situation like you've never seen. How about yesterday, the mobility fundraising that went on yesterday for the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund and the American with Disabilities Act, which was acknowledged this weekend nationwide. But the industry, the outpouring of support for these scenarios, it's a bottomless pocket, and it's to the great credit. The people are so quick to criticize the game and the industry and the stakeholders. That's certainly one thing that everybody deserves all the credit possible.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point. This sport is so steeped in history, and when we don't preserve these voices, we lose them, unfortunately. And you're right, there's a lot of people in this book. And, you know, I've just been working these interviews for 20 years, and yet over that 20-year span, we've lost a lot of the people in this book. And I certainly salute, you know, places like, you know, Keeneland and other places that have tried to, you know, do oral history deals and videos and try to keep alive some of these voices, because you know, if you lose a Penny Chenery or you lose a Ted Bassett or you lose, you know, a Brereton Jones or a Johnny Jones or, you know,
Dr. Lavin
just passed about a month ago. Yep. I mean, the section on Kentucky hard boots, I mean, we've lost Robert Courtney, we've lost Charlie Knuckles. You know, we've lost a lot of these people, Henry White, Smizer West, and Johnny Jones. We've lost all of those people since I interviewed. Hopefully, it had nothing to do with me interviewing them. But to preserve these voices, and you know, that's really a big part of this. So I'm proud of that.
It should be. This was an inspired idea. You told me about this, what, it's got to be 3 years ago, it occurred to you to put the collection together, and anthologies in general, particularly in sports, not limited just to sports, but some of my favorite reading. Red Smith has got the book To Absent Friends, which is specifically about sports figures that had passed. Uh-huh. And it you know, I probably have read it three times in 30 years. And gone back to it, and there's always, you know, it's a treasury, essentially.
There's wisdom there.
Yeah, exactly.
There's accomplishment, there's experience, there's wisdom, and if anybody is thinking about getting into the game or getting deeper into the game, if you're already in it, it pays to pick the brains of the people who have risen to the top. And if you don't take advantage of that, it's just foolish, you know?
No.
So,
well put.
And these are people who, for one reason or another, one way or another, have risen to the top, whether it's by accident or whether it's by hard work or luck or all of the above. But most people say that, you know, you tend to get luckier when you work harder. So, and I believe that.
Luck is the residue of design.
Oh, my.
Branch Rickey.
Talk a little bit about, you know, the history of the game. The history of the game changed in the last year and a half or so with something that changed the history of the world, essentially, with the pandemic. I have said, I'd love your opinion, I've said the last year and a half, I think racing did a great job of kind of powering through the pandemic, better than most of the other sports. What's your take, and then coming up here to Saratoga, where things have kind of gotten back to normal over the past few weeks?
Yeah, I think horse racing could be very proud of what they did during the pandemic. It was the only game in town, and I hope it made friends. It certainly,
I think, yeah.
You know, it's certainly the handle and the numbers and the TV ratings and everything that happened over 2020 certainly would point to that. And, yeah, I'm very proud of the way it's come out of it. I've just done a story for the New York Thoroughbred Breeder magazine on Saratoga, talking to, you know, the assemblywoman, the local assemblywoman here, and the Chamber of Commerce people. And I was amazed. The head of the chamber told me that last year not one business failed in Saratoga. Not one restaurant, not one business closed. The only business that closed was the woman who ran the Five Point Markets, and she ended up opening up a catering business up in Wilton.
Which is a great place for sandwiches. Yeah, Food by Mara.
Yeah, Mara. And somebody else came in and opened that, so that doesn't even count. So, you know, that just goes to show you the resiliency of Saratoga. It's unbelievable through a pandemic that not one restaurant failed. I don't know that anybody would have.
And we did it last year. We did a number of remotes around town and out at Saratoga National, and they were simulcasting the track and getting some pretty good crowds because people still wanted to come up here. They still wanted to experience Saratoga.
Yep.
So we still had the outer towners come up. It was just a different experience at the venues around town. But that was fun to see that everybody said, okay, I can't get into the track, but I still want to go to Saratoga.
Well, the advantage to that is they were paying $99 for a hotel room on Travers weekend, which is about, you know, 10% of what you would normally be paying for a hotel room. So there were attractive, you know, pieces, and with the ability for restaurants to set up tables outdoors, you know, that became something that I think probably will be a permanent thing going forward. It's hugely popular. So I think it's great. Saratoga feels like Saratoga. Everything I've heard, you know, the town is bustling and crazy, and You know, I myself have been waiting for 73 repairmen to come to my house this week, so I'm right in the middle of it.
Well, we've talked about that with Lenny too in previous years, where he had become a area homeowner, but you know, had been renting it out, and so this is really the first opportunity you've had to be in the house during a meet
by myself. And luckily, I've rented it out starting September 1st to a Skidmore professor, so it's actually worked out very well. So nice. I get to spend the summer, and he's taking it for the school term, and then hopefully, you know, next year we can start all over again.
Pretty fun.
And I'll be pushing my Phyllis George biography here. we'll need to have another table here.
Who used to be a regular hanging out with Mary Lou Whitney.
That's right. That's right.
Well, she another kind of intimidating. I mean, to have an audience with Mary Lou Whitney. I mean, there was a line of people in the dining room at Doma. I mean, everybody was waiting to have their word with Mary Lou Whitney. Sure. It was an amazing. When people talk about somebody who comes in and stops a room, she. You know, all eyes turned to her when she walked into a room. It was amazing. It's such a gracious person.
Yeah, I remember years ago, the local radio, one of the local radio stations, Mason and Sheehan, there was one of those kind of morning zoo things.
Yeah.
And they came up and had like a opening day or some kind of party in the morning for their show over at Ciro's, and Mary Lou showed up for that. So she was game. She would show up and... She would play whatever the game was. She would show up when it was Saratoga time.
If you're willing to do the morning zoo, you're totally game. That's whatever the morning zoo is in whatever town it is. Yeah, she was great. There's just so many larger than life people.
And when you mention Mary Lou, I can think of two occasions away from here that were notable too, because she won. She won a, I can't remember if it was a race or a stake at Churchill, and I was there for that, and probably, you know, Derby
Oaks,
Week or Oaks,
the Oaks
and beside Birdtown. I mean, there was Birdtown, of course, winning the Oaks, but I mean recently, you know, as she was getting frail. And then down at Gulfstream, too, I was on hand at Gulfstream one Saturday, or it might have even been a weekday, and she won a race. And wherever... To me, it was very notable that outside of New York and outside of Saratoga, there was the same appreciation and understanding of her import and of her presence that everybody was you know, in awe, essentially. There was that day here just a few years ago, and I've got a great picture of it, when she came and watched a race. I think she had a maiden running. And she watched it from the rail, from the fence, you know, just to the right of the winner's circle. And everybody, you know, up again next to her was like just so tickled. And I mean, there's some funny, you know, there's those funny moments, you know, with her arriving at the party at the Canfield at the casino on the motorcycle. And she just... You know, listen, for a Ziegfeld, when you come up under Flo Ziegfeld, you learn a couple of tricks about entertainment.
The show goes on. But what a love of horses on top of all of that. Just a 3,000,000% love of the game and everything about it.
Well, and I have not read that interview yet, but her cognizance to go... You know, now it's probably 15, 18 years ago, right? Almost 20 years ago, to go bring back those mares, to bring back, you know, all the Whitney mares.
Whitney blood, she called it.
And she reassembled that broodmare band. That was savvy, you know, that went beyond, you know, marrying into the scenario. She, you know, she understood the value and the continuity. You know, much like Charlotte Weber does. I mean, having just lost, you know, the foundation mare, but one of the really you know, essential mares in her broodmare band that was produced 4 millionaires. It's that same win approval. That's the same, you know, mentality. Sid Fernando and I talk about this in a weekly in you know, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and you know that's. Yeah, that's the lifeblood of the bloodstock trade.
Well, you know, speaking of Hillendale, John Sikora always talks about the genetic switch, mostly about stallions, but I guess it goes for mares also. And if they are inclined to produce big stakes winners, you know, you never know, but the switch just goes on, and a horse will just produce and produce and produce. And, you know, to, like you said, Mary Lou Whitney, she got that band back together, and what do you know? One in Oaks, one at Travers, one at Belmont, you know, and whatever else. And Charlotte Weber's, like you said, that one family, you know, two breed. How many Breeders' Cup Mile winners?
Two.
You know, four millionaires out of the mare. And then you'll have
Northern Affleet,
yeah,
and Eltish, yeah, and those, you know, that ilk, Atticus. I mean, pretty crazy.
Doesn't
that's
matter.
Sort of the Fred Hooper in sort of the Fred Hooper mold.
Yeah. Sometimes you bring those horses up to Kentucky, and the stallions don't produce as well as they produced when they were in Florida. It's tough to figure. It's not an exact science, but man, when the switch goes on, it goes on, and those people knew how to do it, and you know, it's
Mary Lou Whitney up
here
in the rain after the trash. She was game. She did, the rain didn't bother
Travers,
her. Dressed up and came up. Talk a little bit about, we've talked about it when we've had you on before, but you had like a whole different writing life earlier on with Dice Clay. And so talk about that and how you transitioned, how you
Anywhere.
Got into the game
Anywhere.
And transitioned into the writing more about horse racing.
Yeah, so, you know, L.A. was very exciting. I was a relative young man when I moved out. I had a newspaper that I founded in Tucson before I moved to L.A., and it's the greatest time of my life doing that. But, you know, after we stiffed every printing press in town because we just didn't have the money, we finally had to shut down. And to me, the next frontier was L.A. So I left Tucson and moved to L.A. knowing nothing or nobody. And, Marshall's... I'm so thankful I got a job on a children's show called Kids Incorporated, which started the careers of Jennifer Love Hewitt and Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas. They were all eight-year-old girls on this kids show. And Mario Lopez, who I still don't know what he does, but he's famous for being Mario Lopez. Anyway, he was on it. So it was a wildly successful show, and the same producer who did that sent me out to a comedy club to find a host for a comedy show we were trying to get on a pilot. And I sat there all night, and I said, the next day, I said, I didn't see anybody who could host the show, but I saw a guy at 1:30 in the morning do a routine I've never seen before. I was literally rolling in the aisle. I like the expression. He goes, what's his name? I said, Andrew Dice Clay. He goes, I know Andrew. He used to bug me when I was doing In Concert in New York. He wanted to come up during the set changes and do 5 minutes. And this. So because I mentioned his name, he called Andrew that day. Andrew had just gotten his HBO special deal. He hired Tommy to produce the show. The next day, Andrew's in the office. I meet him. We hit it off. And so we ended up working together for like 10 years, and the time of my life. I mean, the show Entourage on HBO could have been about Andrew and the wacky cast that we had around at that point. But so it's just a wildly non-linear, you know, LA-like life. It just goes in every direction. You have to be ready. And, you know, writing is writing. You know, you write for a kid's show, and then all of a sudden you're doing 30 nursery rhymes. You know, 6 months later, it's a little odd that you're doing horse racing. Trevor Denman, I give all the credit to for getting me back into horse racing. When I was in L.A., he had a nightly replay show where he replayed the races with his calls, and also he hosted it. And I just was so taken with this guy's calls of the races and this whole thing. I had lost horse racing for 20 years since my dad used to take me to Belmont. And I used to go to Roosevelt every night because I lived right by it. And man, it just came back like a flip of a switch. And when L.A. got to be a little much, I thought, you know, this Kentucky thing sounds pretty good. Let me try to do that. So again, you know, you take your rider, you take your pen and your eraser, and you go and you start doing horses.
It's funny because Sean Clancy had a nice little column in the Saratoga Special just within the past week or so talking about listening to podcasts. There's a certain podcast he listened to where the host asks a bunch of entrepreneurs, how much of what where you've gotten is luck and how much is hard work? And then his whole column was about that. And that's pretty much an example. You're a great writer, put a lot of hard work into it, but there's certainly just some lucky coincidences that took you in great directions.
Yeah, the spokes coming out of a wheel. You can go in all different directions. And just Kentucky seemed really attractive to me after 20 years in L.A. It was very claustrophobic, and, you know, you guys have been out there driving around. You can sit in traffic for... So I like the open spaces, and Kentucky has really been everything that I would have hoped that it would have been.
Yeah, pretty nice.
I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah, well, and as I say, talented as well, yeah, as demonstrated by the books we have here. Again, one more time, the book signing.
North Shire Books, Friday, August 6th, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., 424 Broadway. Come on by, and I know you're going to enjoy the book. If you love anything about this sport, you'll really get a kick out of it.
And again, for folks who aren't familiar with Saratoga, you will not miss the North Shire. It's right in the middle of things, right in the middle of Broadway, so you will have no trouble finding that on Friday.
And when you put North Shire into your ways, be careful about ending up in Manchester, Vermont, because that's the flagship.
Oh, that's their other store.
That's the flagship store for years.
Right.
Really nice, too.
Well, I'll go there, too, if there's business.
You should tell them.
I love Manchester.
They do. They have signings all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Well, and if anybody's heading today, if you got the family and they don't know what to do, it's getting a little bit, well, it's 10:30. you head out, go out to Dorset, go to Dorset, Vermont, just north of Manchester. Sundays is the farmer's market. So go to Dorset, which is a lovely town in its own right, and then come back down to Manchester and stop at Wilcox at the little roadside ice cream stand on your way back to New York. So send, if you've got, you know, spouse doesn't want to come to the races today, the Dorset farmer's market. And
drop them off in Manchester. You once made fun of me at Churchill Downs because I was wearing a Woolrich shirt, a flannel.
Yeah.
Yes, I made a comment about your suit not matching, so of course you had to go after me. but there is a Woolrich outlet store in Manchester. Or at least there was the last time I was there.
The outlet. The outlet scene has dissipated. At Manchester, shockingly, it's about half as many as there used to be. I mean, there's still a few, but it's not like it used to be.
Because that impressed the hell out of me that there was a Woolrich outlet store there. That was big for me.
That's interesting. I'm trying to think of where it even was. I think
it was in the middle, near the middle of town, now, a little bit north.
Orvis is like the 800-pound gorilla, or you know, the 19-pound trout.
If you're going to refer to Orvis. And also I want to mention, because I found it amazing you go over state lines for this, but don't you get your hair cut in Vermont?
In Bennington, and I think on Wednesday. I'm back down Wednesday.
Is that
after
true?
The show.
You go to Vermont to get the haircut?
Over state
Jenna,
lines.
Yeah.
Do you pick up the hemp oil while you're over?
No, that's one of our sponsors, Healthnetics. And I should actually have the tincture or the ointment for you, but I'll get it from you. For this week, there's the tincture under the tongue, and then there's the
topical
ointment.
The
topical, because I've got psoriatic arthritis, and Marty McGee is the one who got me onto it, and it you know, it's temporary relief. Obviously, it's not going to cure it, but when your hand cramps and stuff like it's amazing. And I thought the whole thing was nonsense, the whole CBD thing. Marty said try this, and now they're I'm like Victor Kiam. I didn't buy the company, but I absolutely believe.
You've never looked better.
Why, thank you. By the way, you've got to sign. You can't come to this set and not sign something. The last time he was here, he became a witness on our wills. The two of them had to witness.
Signed something. Yeah. I signed 89,000 pages. Signed something. This guy's will is like this, like he owns more than John Hendrickson does. It's unbelievable. Tina still hasn't found the money.
What I haven't found is the actual wills we've been waiting for. They're in Syracuse. I keep asking, are you going to send them to us at some point?
Have you paid him?
Yes. Paid him 10 minutes after the bill came, $1,000 to prepare the two wills. And you know, we're going to end up intestate here.
They're safe. They're in the office. They're safe.
I hope the lawyer has a will.
Unbelievable. All right, so you sign my book. Yes. We're going to take a break. We got to get Marshall Graham in here. Excited to have Marshall.
Great, Marshall Graham.
And he's got a – I didn't even know when I asked him yesterday. I didn't realize that he had the homebred running today. 10-strike racing, he and Clay Sanders. So we'll talk not just about that. We'll also talk imputed odds and all the other fascinating things that come with Marshall Graham. And remind, head-to-head, the great, wonderful –
always one of our favorite visits. The crew is always
very big in the trailer. Very big in the trailer.
Back after this, Loose on the Lead continues.
Welcome to Albany County, an incredible destination to live, work, and play, with easy connections to more than a dozen cities from our vibrant modern airport. It's a short trip downtown to a hive of culture and amusement, from world-class shows at the newly renovated Times Union Center to reliving the past at the New York State Museum. From outdoor recreation to shopping to nightlife, Albany County has something for everyone. We'll see you soon.
Capital OTV is now streaming live on Roku. The RTN Racing Channel on Roku lets you watch OTV TV live through your Roku device or your Amazon Fire Stick, rather than being limited to computers and mobile devices, which means you can now watch OTV live wherever you are. Simply open Roku, scroll to find the RTN channel, then click on OTV TV. OTV TV on Roku. Try it now.
Stone is an outside threat. They're coming down to the finish. Can Smarty Jones hold on? Here comes Birdstone. Birdstone surges past. Birdstone wins the Belmont Stakes.
Welcome back to Loose on the Lead. Seth Merrow and Steve Bick. Another big Sunday action-packed version of Loose on the Lead. Thanks to Lenny Shulman for stepping in. And now we're joined by our friend Marshall Graham, contest player, college professor, a guy who plugs in the numbers on horse racing. We will talk about all of that. Marshall, good morning.
Great to be here. I appreciate y'all having me on.
Thanks for stopping by. As I say, we'll hit on a number of topics. But one of them I want to talk a little bit about. 10-strike racing. You got into the game. I would see, as I did the afternoon handicapping show during most of the year, I'll see 10-strike racing. But, boy, over the last year, it seems like I see a lot of 10-strike in with some partners as well. How many horses do you have currently running?
We have probably about 40 that are currently active, and we're all over the place. So we're a little bit bigger than we're a lot of smoke and mirrors, right? We have a couple nice horses, a lot of claimers. So we do show up around the country in the entry box, but people think we're bigger than we really are, but it's fun. We have partners involved in some of our nicer horses. I've got others that are involved in claimers. We claimed Seafoam the other day out of that out of that optional 45 with a couple of New York guys. And so, we're trying to be involved in the game every different facet. We sent some horses over to Del Mar for the Ship and Win. And, you know, part of what we do, obviously, we have our nicer horses with Brad Cox, but I like really helping these younger trainers getting a start. We have Michelle Giangiulio. She trains for us here in New York, and she's had 4 starters, 2 seconds, 2/3, and she's doing everything. She's galloping, she's grooming, she's hot walking, she's training, so she's a one-man operation for us, and we're excited for her. Doing a little rain dance today. I know for most of us, we want the rain to stay here, to keep off, and keep this beautiful weather, but we've got one MTO in the 6, and we'd like to see Michelle get off the duck for her career. Matt Shire trains for us, and he's out at Del Mar for the Ship and Win, and he won his he won on Friday night, won his first race at Del Mar, and Bentley Combs has been up here and started horse for us. So we also are trying to get younger trainers their starts, you know, trying to help them become the next Brad Cox.
Yeah, that's great. And just before I hand it over to Steve, the 10 Strike name, where's that come from?
So 10 Strike, 10 Strike was the name of the first winner of the Tennessee Derby. And so back in the, before gambling was sort of outlawed everywhere, but in Tennessee in 1905, the 1870s, 1880s, the Tennessee Derby in Memphis was as big as the Kentucky Derby. Now that's more to be saying the Kentucky Derby was fairly small time, but the Tennessee Derby was a big race, and it took place at the Memphis Fairgrounds, which is about a mile away from where I live. And Ten Strike was the son of the famous Ten Brook, right? And so a Hall of Fame horse, and a horse that they sang bluegrass songs about. So that's where we came up with Ten Strike Racing. Had a nice ring to it, you know, it allows us to put together partnerships and do things in a more cohesive way than trying to get 50 names on a horse's entry.
Sure, I like it. Steve?
Talk about the horse today, and more in broad terms, not necessarily just about Whittington Park, but you plugged into the New York Bred program pretty quickly. Dot Matrix became a stalwart, regular, amazing. Has made how many starts now?
He's made 40 starts. Now, Dot Matrix ran the other day for an optional 80 and finished 4th, and you know, he got a good break and kind of ran his race. He's always been horrible out of the gate, spotting the field 2 or 3 lengths, so he broke well and ran well, and you know, just didn't quite have his closing kick. He's 8 years old now, so we retired him the other day.
Oh, did you really?
He got on the van on Tuesday, is headed to Kentucky, and he'll be working a new job. We're going to work on retraining him and getting him, you know, whether he's a hunter jumper or whatever he might do. He's super sound and was a great race horse to us. You know, was a homebred out of the first mare I ever owned. Was the 3rd horse I bred, the maybe 2nd horse I dropped up here in New York. And again, it's a wonderful experience to have a New York bred. The horse earned $700,000 and won stakes races, and you get breeders awards for it. So we've been, you know, big participants in the New York bred program. We board 3 or 4 mares up with Keen Stud in Amenia, New York.
Okay.
And it's an excellent program. And, you know, I think the one nice thing about these breeders' programs, whether it's in New York or Pennsylvania, we participate in both, is it creates the incentive to breed a sound horse, right? So we get rewarded whether we own the horse or not, based on how it runs. And, the longer career that horse has, the better it is for us. So we, you know, Dot Matrix made 40 starts. We have a firster today named Whittington Park. She has a sibling that's made 60 starts in the Mid-Atlantic. And so, you know, I take to the breeding shed race mares that, you know, have, you know, maybe aren't the most talented, maybe aren't the best pedigree, but they're sturdy. Breed them to sturdy stallion. I love Freud, and you know, every once in a while you get lucky with Dot Matrix. This Whittington Park today, we've got a horse in the first, is a Midnight Lute. It's by our mare, See the Force. See the Force is the first horse that Clay Sanders and I won a race together on. So
Wow.
It's our second horse we ever owned, first horse we won a race on. She actually broke down at Delaware Park, and we saved her. She barely made it, and she's been a very productive broodmare for us. Her mom was Critical Eye, and Critical Eye was a millionaire.
Tremendous,
right?
New York bred.
So, you know, the first New York bred to ever make $1 million, and so See the Force has been a very productive broodmare for us. Funny story. See the Forest has her previous foal was Critical Value, and Critical Value was a multiple stakes winner for us with Jeremiah Englehart. Well, Critical Value had so many problems at the farm and was so unspectacular early in her career when she was being broken and trained that, you know, we were told to consider giving her away.
And so we went to Engelhart. We didn't put her in our partnerships, and went to Engelhart and said, look, we want our mare to have a winner. If we end up at Finger Lakes running for 10, let's just get our maiden one and then retire her. Well, she wins at Saratoga. She wins the Maid of the Mist. She wins the Boeri. And so she had a great career. She's been off and on again injured, and we've retired her and going to add her to our broodmare van. But it shows we've thrown all her siblings in our partnerships, and that horse is the nicest one so far.
Amazing.
And,
she wound up with a New York bred trophy at the end of the year,
so
right?
She was champion New York bred 2-year-old. And so, we very much enjoyed having that horse, Clay and I did, but we wish our partners could have involved. And sometimes, trying to help your partners out, you just never know when they might pop. Winning Park's one that we were very excited about. We don't know whether today's the day. You hear about all these potential hot horses in this race, but been training well. The Scopey horse, who should be able to go longer, is also sibling to Steam Engine, who is a 2-year-old was Sprinty, right? 1 second out, and we think this horse is, probably has a little bit more talent than Steam Engine. That's the comp because Brad had Steam Engine, not technical value. But should be able to go longer. So, we're hopeful for a sign of life today. Doesn't have to win today, but we'd like to see a big effort. And again, we're excited about this horse's future. Horse has been training very well. Again, but like everyone else in this race, it's a Saratoga. Even a New York bred race, it's a Saratoga 2-year-old race. So we'll see how it goes.
And I know Steve has some specific numbers questions and whatnot, but before we get to that, I just want to mention you are a college professor, and I love that whenever I read about your teaching, the racing form maybe is involved in class and whatnot. That's great. If people follow your Twitter feed, you have great numbers and you analyze the game. It's very interesting. I advise people to check that out. But I'd love to know how you got into the game, how you became interested, because you're a player, you're a contest player, you're now a prominent owner. So how'd you first get into the game?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and weirdly enough, D.C. did not have cable television until 1989. And so when I was 16, so I was a sports junkie as a kid, and my access to sports is very limited when you only had a couple TV stations. And so I read the newspaper and Sports Illustrated voraciously and loved sports writing. It was an early favorite was Bill Knack, obviously, and Rick Tellender. These are my favorite writers. And Andy Beyer wrote for the Washington Post.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read everything he wrote, and that sucked me in. In part, it's the fact that Beyer is such a, obviously a wonderful handicapper and changed the game with the speed figures. But he's a wonderful writer, and I think people, you could just go back and read those books for how well he writes and the stories he tells. And so, I loved reading his column. There was 2 pages on horse racing. I looked at the charts, got into the numbers. Boys get into baseball when they're kids because of the stats. Yeah. I got into horse racing. I read all of Beyer's books, would make the mile walk to the People's Drugstore to buy the racing form for $2 back then, and come up with my own little handicapping systems. And it kind of never left. I went to graduate school, got my PhD in economics, started teaching. And I'm evaluated, half on teaching, half on research. And I was doing boring stuff on bank regulation, typical econ, dull stuff. And I realized that my one interest is consuming interest is horse racing, and found that there was a pretty broad literature on horse racing and racing markets as sort of proxies for financial markets. Because, the tote board is this mechanism that brings people together and establishes prices. So it's really a market at work, and it's extremely efficient. And I found that I could do research on horse racing or related to horse racing enough, and so it's been the vehicle that got me tenure and full professor at Rhodes, and I've published over a dozen articles on sort of racing related stuff. And then from there got into gambling, had a little success gambling that allowed me to buy a few racehorses. I met Clay, we started buying horses at the same time, and then we started together putting together partnerships to bring our friends in to allow us to buy more horses, to allow us to take a shot with some better horses, spend a little bit more money. And it's been a wonderful experience. I've met so many people through racing, through handicapping, through ownership, gotten some people in the game who've gone on and owned other horses. And again, for us, we're a closed stable. We don't advertise. We don't really have a budget. Clay and I don't make money off our partnership. We're investors like everyone else, but it's allowed us to have, instead of having 2, 3, 4 horses, allowed us to have a very large stable, and allowed us to roll the dice on some claims and to buy some yearlings and 2-year-olds. And again, hope for the nice horse. It's what we all want, hoping for the nice horse.
Exactly. Exactly right. You mentioned some of the financials and Seth referencing the interest in discussing some of the particulars. And, you and I, and you've done it with us here as well, use you as a resource to explain to the betting public some of the most difficult areas of concern, because the game has with modernization, people want to pretend that the game hasn't modernized sufficiently, but really maybe to its detriment, it has modernized for a certain class of participant, and that includes the computerized assisted wagering moniker, the teams, the groups as they're referred to. Before we talk any specifics, Marshall, your impression of their import, the liquidity they provide, the positive or negative influence, give everybody that is a rank and file player that's putting in bets one at a time, or maybe is utilizing their interface for some smaller batch betting, but explain, I don't want to say why this is a threat and why it's a problem. I don't want to make people have a preconceived notion, but your impressions and the basic overview of what computerized assisted wagering is doing in our marketplace.
Well, I tend to be more pro computer wagering. They add a lot of liquidity to our pools. They're handicapping to some extent. You may be looking at the form, following certain horses. They're building economic models, regression models, prediction models, coming up with probabilities, betting into all these different pools. The one advantage that they have is they're able to, bet up to the last minute, incorporating the odds. The odds are a big part of the equation. I talked about how the tote board, the public is the best handicap out there. Well, they're able to, in an instant, process those odds with their models and spit out probabilities where in the last seconds they can make bets, right? And they're doing it in many cases through, maybe they have a direct access to the tote, but even without direct access, I do a little bit of sort of computer-assisted wagering, and we do it right through the front end. The computer logs into my account and loads bets. And so, it's something that's not going anywhere. I do think that we overthink it. I think there's some paranoia about computer wagering, in part because of the way that we talk about these ways that computers build their models. Words like AI, words like machine learning, makes it sound like the computer's doing everything. But fundamentally, a team that builds a handicapping model, right, they're working with a lot of data. They are, they're continually tweaking their model, and they don't always necessarily win, and their margins are very small. Now, in terms of their contribution to the betting pool, remember that the tracks, get a amount that it comes from the bettors, right? The track gets a piece, and then the ADWs get a piece. And on recreational players, the ADW holds a pretty good margin. On computer players or high volume players or professional bettors, the ADW's margin is much smaller. The track itself is getting the same rate. So the ADW uses that margin to try to incent their bettors to bet more. And so in many ways, it's good that their bettors are betting more. I mean, for myself, going from a recreational player when I was just starting to being a little bit more involved in computer betting and learning more and participating more, my betting volume has jumped tremendously, and part of that has been aided by facing a lower takeout that's a result of the rebates we get. My problems with the computer betting are that that they have some unfair advantages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the biggest unfair advantage is that they can process bets much quicker than a regular horse player. So if I use an Excel spreadsheet to upload a pick six ticket, right, that to me is something that most anyone can do, right? Write something, put in some tickets. When I upload that ticket, it processes bets at 3 bets per second, right? So if, you make a pick six with A's, B's, C's, and D's, right, even using some of these prepackaged uploading programs, you better be careful about getting shut out. Right? And so computers can upload bets at a much faster processing speed. Now, I would be for allowing everyone that faster processing speed, because I do think the future is that a lot of these younger players, they will be, I wouldn't necessarily call them like, computer teams, but they're going to do more modeling. They're going to work with data. They're going to involve computers more in betting. And I think as a traditional horse player, there's still room for the traditional horse player. When you look at a race, you need to sort of have an idea of where the computers are going to go, right? And you need to find a reason why you might be different than what they're doing. And you know, I look at certain races, and if I can't, if there are horses that have a lot of starts and at the same track, right, computers are going to have a big advantage in those spots because they have a lot of data to work with. But races that, you know, go from turf to dirt, or there's a lot of firsters, or there's horses with very few starts, those are harder for computers. Also, I talk about this constantly with my students. A lot of this is, what we do is small sample size decision making. If you come up with a stat and find a trainer that's really successful with a certain move over a large sample, well, it's baked in. The computers and everyone else knows about it. So you have to look for these trends very quickly, right? And, you know, who's hot at the meet, who's
emergent.
Who's riding well, and even if it's just a few starts, right, you have to look at that and decide whether that is some sort of signal or whether it's just randomness and noise. And that's I think, the key to modern handicapping, because the board and the public, whether it's the public or whether it's computers, everyone is a lot smarter. We don't have, you know, we don't have the numbers players anymore, right? They're playing the lottery or they're going to the casinos, right? So it's not just the computers that make this game tough. It's that the public is so much more educated. When we all started following racing, there were only a few books to read. Now you watch shows like your show, you watch the Fox show or TVG, you can learn very quickly. You listen to your radio show, right? Players learn really quickly, a lot of resources.
That's the challenge in and of itself. Even without the computer-assisted wagering scenario, you already had a marketplace and a landscape that had been inundated. There's start with sheet figures, with Ragazin and Thorograph. Fold in the clocking reports that have proliferated. It used to be just on the West Coast with Andy Harrington, National Turf, and now that is really a national, you know, with DRF expanding and having more and more reports available. I mean, the amount of information that is now in the hands of players makes it that much harder.
Well, look at Friday's daily recap. Favorites winning meet to date, 38.8%. It's almost 40%. Mm-hmm. The betting public is just far more savvy now because of all this information that's available to them.
The topic, though, there's a couple of things, and you know, we don't have unlimited time, but there are a couple of things that you could drill down on. And one of the things that I find in my conversations, I've been doing the radio show 15 years, and no matter how many times I explain the graphics package on odds at post time when the bell rings and odds that seemingly change during the running of the race, no matter how many times it's explained to people, they still want to insist that there's this elite group that is betting after the bell. And I understand why the perception is there, and we don't have to explain it yet again. However, the biggest impact to me that the groups have had is sapping value out of the exotics, specifically the exacta pool. And take a second and explain how those algorithms and its probing mechanics are looking at that grid. When you see the will pay grid of, the will pay exacta, one with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, their system is going through and looking at the probability of the exacta combinations and then sending in bets at the last second to try to level that out when their probe is finding anomalies. And that's why when you're looking at that will pay of an $89 exacta, that by the time it crosses the wire, it pays out at $67, it's because of this. And to me, it's a little insidious. It's legal, and I understand, and I get all the elements, but it's a perception problem for the general public that no matter how many times we explain the mechanics, they won't accept. And it's particularly damaging for new players coming in who feel like I'm getting cheated, and there's no worse feeling. And we're, you know, with the potential to alienate prospective players. The sophisticated player understands this, and if they're playing on, they're accepting it. But there's a group of players out there that are seeing things like this. They're not understanding. They're not working it through or asking questions. They're just walking away, and that is a huge problem long term.
Yeah, well, I mean, I took my son to the races, and he sees his horse that he bets go off from 7-2 to 2-1, and so it's jarring to see that, especially as you know horse players were taught to look for value, and that's an ever changing target with what's happening to the pools. And you know, it's one thing up here, where we have a lot of money come in early. If you look at the minor tracks, they're getting 40% of the money that clears in the last tick, and it dramatically changes things. And so, I think, one, it's not a solution, but one starting point is the using some of the will pays for the doubles and the pick threes.
The imputed odds.
To impute odds to get a better projection of where the win odds are going. From that, you can sort of even impute where exactas might go. Exact is a little bit trickier, but the markets have all become extremely efficient because any anomaly that exists is arbitraged away, right? And that's something that's in the past 10 years is just true. The computers are basically trying to make these markets efficient. It used to be, I'd say when I started doing a little computer betting 10 years ago, it could be you could use some information in certain pools to bet into others and try to arbitrage away those differences. That's gone. You remember even back in the 70s, the old Dr. Z system, William Ziemba had to use the win pool to bet in the place and show pool, right? And those are all things that used to work in an arbitrage way. The first sort of computer betting I ever did was, write something to where to do the Dr. Z bet, right? There's a little window where that worked, but those have gone away. Computers have made those markets more efficient, and I don't see a way to prevent it, right? I mean, I think we need better tools that can help recreational players compete with the computers. I'd like for the ADWs to innovate more in bet construction. So when I like a couple horses, instead of saying, well, I like the 3 and 8, I want to key them, and so I do a 3-8 box, and then let's make a try 3-8 all 3-8 or 3-8 all, which is inefficient. Well, maybe you could build something that sort of projects those odds for those other horses, and that you can then come up with efficient tickets that they can fire off and play like computer bettors. Because ultimately betting is about finding your key horses, and it's not, what's the tricky part is constructing your tickets. I like a I like a horse to win, but I also think this 20-1 might run a little bit better than the public sees it. How do I make the efficient tickets to take advantage of that? A computer can do that based upon its probabilities and using the publics. For me as a bettor, I'm doing it by hand. I'm using the all button. Yep. And if we can build some tools to help players do that and to help grab some of that information from the odds board, I think that can really help. Because I think that, that what you're saying is absolutely right. The first step, they see all this, and it's a struggle, but I do believe in the parimutuel game. I think it's the best form of gambling.
Well, what's your take on fixed odds?
That's the right follow up. Yeah.
I mean, I'm neutral. I'll just be neutral. I don't believe it's the savior that people believe it to be. I don't believe it's the devil either, right? And so I would say that I'm pro fixed odds, and that I'd like to see it because I'd like to be able to I'd like to be able to make a futures Breeders' Cup bet. Right, my sneaky futures Breeders' Cup bet is Knicks go, by the way. So I'd like to be able to do stuff like that, I don't think it'll leak that much from the parimutuel pools because
it hasn't in Australasia.
In
New Zealand, Australia, where this model came from, it has not. It has not taken away, even though it's become a larger percentage of the overall hand.
And it will help with price discovery.
Yeah.
Because the idea that people says, well, I the morning line was 10-1, and it looked like it'd be 5-1, and went up at 2-1. The fixed odds aren't going to be 10-1, right? The fixed odds are going to be gravitate towards what the odds are with good bookmakers.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't see it as a problem in terms of pulling a lot of money away from the pools. I also think that, I don't see how it's going to affect exactas, tries, and supers. But again, I don't claim to be an expert on it either. I don't have a dog in that fight really, because it's sort of can go either way. I hear both sides.
To me, the biggest advantage that it has is for the neophyte player. And where I've shaken out on this as a topic was formed by my relationship with my wife, who was a mutual right here in the backyard. And things that Tina would tell me, at the end of the day, and the thing that registered with me the most, and as I started to get involved in the radio show, the frustration of the young player that looked up at the board with 8 minutes to go and bet a horse at 8-1 and then goes up expecting, you know, almost a $20 win return. And it ended up coming down to 5-1. And it said, well, the horse was 8-1. Well, it was an 8-1 when you bet it, but it's a parimutuel. So you sort of have to explain this stuff to people. And this is already a daunting task to explain the entire system and the way this works to people. So to then have that frustration, then there's other little nuances like the stupidity involved in presenting will pays or presenting or posting the payouts in increments above what people may have betted. So when you've got a 50-cent option and you're presenting a $2 thing and somebody goes up and says, well, it says $120, why am I getting 30? Well, at 50 cents, they're deflating. You don't want anybody walking away from the window feeling badly.
After they catch the ticket.
You make a winning bet, you're supposed to be ecstatic, not pissed off. It's mind-boggling, and the industry has had years to fix this and is just myopic about it. It's mind-numbing. It drives me crazy.
Well, what is amazing is that there's a lot of time between races to display all sorts of information.
Yeah.
And so you would think that they could do some of that in the way that they display their odds. Yeah. There's no one saying this is the way it has to be. And so, you know, I'm just waiting for one track to kind of do it. And I do see some innovation. You know, I was watching Emerald the other night, and they post fractions, and they have the how far off par it is, so you can watch a race and know whether it's going fast or slow. Because with different run up times, you don't necessarily know, is that a fast fraction or slow fraction? Wait a minute, the gate's really close. And so I like to see tracks experimenting. And again, with all that dead time, show us some projected odds, right? I mean, why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And show us some, you know, different ways to display these will pays. It's a matter of, you know, there are many different tracks. Just someone do it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But let's roll the dice and see how it might work.
Well,
and,
we kind of hit on it a moment ago, but it's worth explaining to people who may not realize it. Using those will pays to kind of figure the odds at post time, because I've started to do that more and more, where you look up 5 minutes to post and you see 6-1 on a horse that you think, how is this horse 6-1? Well, go and then pull up the will pays in the double and you see, oh, this horse is the favorite in the double. So we're not going to get that 6-1.
Andy Serling has been explaining this for a decade. And one of the first things when he starts the prattle between races, is one of the first things he'll say is X is, you know, is this price, but based on the will pays, will end up being about 7-2.
Sure enough, at post time.
Andy's the only person in punditry that ever that has been doing this for an extended period. You came along on Twitter and started to put the imputed odds based on the 2-day bets, things like the Oaks Derby double. That has been helpful, and you're trying to infiltrate people's minds and help them understand, as opposed to believing that, you know, something nefarious is going on. I mean, that to me, you know, netting that out is a priority, but then helping them understand, you know, what else they can glean from those kinds of information packages. So you're 100% right, and there's, you know, I've actually reached out to a few, I've given your number to a few people about, you know, and Paul Matisse as well, about, you know, helping them develop a program that's easy for them, you know, to create the graphic patch.
It's a simple calculation, and so just throw up the graphic. Yeah. I'll give you the great example. In the Belmont Stakes betting, the central quality was 2-1, 9-5, 9-5, 9-5, 9-5, dropped to 6-5 as the race went off. Well, in both the 2-day and 1-day double, he projected the 6-5. So you have a little projected thing up there that says projects a 6-5.
Expect.
Now, it's not going to be perfect.
But it's already based on betting that's happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's already based on, and you're using the whole double matrix. And so that's quite a bit of information. And so it won't be perfect, and you won't get it for the first race. But at a bigger track like Saratoga, Del Mar, Naira, you know, it's pretty darn good. Yeah. The smaller tracks less good, but at least it's some information. Because at smaller tracks, the tote board means very little until 2 minutes to post, right? Yeah. And so, you know, to me, I say, why not give it a try? It's one screen, you flash it up. It doesn't work, right? But It's an easy calculation. Let's give it a shot, right? Why not?
No doubt.
If anyone has any questions about that, I mean, you know, anyone who works for a track wants to try it, just give me a call. I mean, it's easy to go through.
Right? We're gonna I did this a couple of months ago, and I got sort of let it slide, and now I got to give them another push.
Great discussion, but we are running late here, so I hate to stop the discussion.
Always.
But first, give your Twitter handle, folks. Want to follow
that. At Truxton Stables. I need to change that because you haven't used Truxton in 10 years. But someone took at DGen Prof, so I can't use that. And but anyway, at Truxton Stables on Twitter, 10 Strike Racing. I think 10strikeracing.com. Look for our runners across the country.
Including today.
I appreciate y'all having me on.
It's always a great discussion. And I will advise checking out the Twitter feed because you had some nice graphics on there looking at jockeys and trainers that get out of the gate fastest. And no surprise, Wesley Ward was on top. Those 4.5 furlong sprints, I always say to people, his horses get out of the gate fast. Yeah, 4.5 furlongs, that's what you want. So that was a nice graphic as well, but a lot of good information there. So again, appreciate your stopping by.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Marshall Graham, Steve Bick, Seth Merrill. We'll wrap it up for this Sunday. You're back in next Sunday, right? You don't have to think about it. You're in next Sunday. Because we will be joined by the Matisse brothers next Sunday.
That's right, exactly. And but
then we'll wish everybody Merry Christmas.
the greatest.
Very good. All right, we'll wrap it up for this Sunday. Great day again. It has been a fabulous weekend, Friday, Saturday, and now it's going to be a nice Sunday, too. So come on up, make some money. We'll see you again as far as the programming here on the network Wednesday morning. Enjoy the races. Thanks for tuning in.
You're watching OTB TV, a service of Capital Off-Track Betting.